We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
On the Wolfpack Sports Network from Learfield IMG College.
Play ball!
Welcome to the Nevada Wolfpack Baseball Podcast. Here's your host, Josh Sushon.
Hi again, everyone. Welcome to the latest edition of Howling with the Pack. This is a podcast about the University of Nevada baseball team. We are now up to episode 6. I'm your host, Josh Sushon, and very excited about this week's guest. He pitched for the University of Nevada 1999 and 2000. He was a second-round pick of the Houston Astros in 2000. He pitched 14 years in the major leagues for 9 different teams, most known for his time with the Astros, as he was with those Astros teams that went to the playoffs in 2004 and reached the World Series in 2005. Chad Qualls, 844 games in the major leagues over 14 years. Welcome to the podcast, Chad. Thanks for joining us.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
All right. So we're not going to get into everything about your life because we don't want to take up too much of your time. But since this is a podcast about the Wolfpack primarily, kind of wanted to go down memory lane and talk about just some of your experiences, your memories of pitching for the Wolfpack. So you went to Narbonne High School in Southern California, went to L.A. Harbor Junior College. Tell us about just the journey from high school to JC and then how you ended up in Reno.
Man, I mean, it's kind of funny when I tell people the journey that I've been on. I mean, they've never believed, you know, some of the schools I played against in high school and then going into junior college. But Narbonne High was just my local high school. And I tried to transfer out of there because it was just 10, 11, 12. And I was trying to transfer out of there just to go to a different school that was in a better neighborhood. But they wouldn't let me since I didn't do it my ninth grade year. So I ended up going to school there. And, you know, I was a little kid. I didn't grow until my 11th and 12th grade year in high school. So I was on JV all the way up till my 11th grade year. And then I was on the varsity team like halfway through my junior year, they put me on the varsity team. So I was just this small little skinny kid. And I tell everybody, like, if you ever watched like, you know, Boys in the Hood or movies like that, like our league was literally Dorsey, Crenshaw, and Washington. And then it was Narbonne. Like when we would play Dorsey, we would play at a park. And it would just be like softball field, softball field, softball field, and softball field. And I just had a chalk line that I would pitch from.
Really?
And it was, there was no mound. There was no fences. We used street cones as like a fence because it was a park. And I was, and people are just like cracking up. I'm like, that's just, you know, how we played. And then, you know, we were pretty good. And then, like I said, I didn't start growing until I got into junior college. And so I was nowhere near good enough. I mean, I think my senior year, I was throwing like 80 or 82. So I was nowhere near good enough to go to a, let alone a D1 school, but just college in general to go play baseball. So I just went to my local junior college, which was LA Harbor. And there was a really good program. So I was fortunate enough that we had a great coach there, Tony Bloomfield, and just started to develop a little bit more there and kind of got a little bit more mentally tough. You know, when you go to junior colleges, I mean, it's a lot of, you know, kind of in your face and toughing you up. And, you know, that was really good too, because we ended up finishing like fourth in the state there. And I just kind of slowly kept getting bigger and bigger. And my freshman year in junior college, I finally got up to 6'4", but I weighed 165 pounds. So
you were 6'4", and how much did you weigh?
165.
Okay.
Yeah. Like my junior year of high school, I was like 5'8", and then I grew to like 6 foot that next year. And then the next year I went to 6'4". So like in 2 years I grew like 8 inches. And I mean, I was just a straight stick. And I think I was like up to like 84, 85. And then my sophomore year, I was like 87, 88. So I just kept getting a little bit harder and a little bit better every year. And I guess Bloomfield, he had a pipeline into Nevada, Reno. And so my sophomore year, I had a ton of schools that wanted me to go there, but none of them were giving me a scholarship. So Nevada, I never even took a trip there. They were the only school that really wanted to give me a scholarship. And so I just asked my coaches, you know, is it a good school? Is it this? And there was one other teammate of mine that was going to school there. So I was like, well, I'll just go to Nevada. No big deal. And so I ended up going to Nevada. I mean, I didn't even take a trip. I didn't do anything. I just packed up my stuff, signed my letter of intent and went there and ended up being one of the better choices of my life that, you know, I had a blast there.
So you step on campus to start as a student and you had never seen the city. You had never seen the campus.
Mm-hmm. Wow. No. Yeah. I just trust everybody's word and, you know, wanted to go somewhere that was going to give me a scholarship and give me a chance to play and let me try to just continue getting better at the next level. And they were the right fit for me and, you know, ended up being great choice.
Who was the junior college teammate who became the teammate at Nevada?
Well, it was a guy named Paul Bartolucci. And I think he played 1 year and then I went to school there, but then he flunked out. And then I never even ended up playing with him.
Okay.
I met a ton of good guys there and I still have a ton of friends in Nevada. And, you know, a lot of my friends and my close companions are all ex teammates, ex baseball players, a lot of college guys, still a lot of minor league guys, a lot of big league guys. So,
What about Gary Powers? He was your head coach. Describe what your relationship with him and what he did in order to help make you a better baseball player.
I mean, Gary, you know, since he was the head coach, he dealt with the hitters all the time. So he, you know, I had a totally fine relationship with him as long as I went out there every Friday and did my job. And, you know, he left me alone. It was pretty much me and Stan Stolte over there. And it was a great dynamic between everybody. Cause I tried to go out there and get the win or keep us in the ball game on Friday. And everybody just kind of let me do my thing. I mean, even Stolte, I didn't have the cleanest of mechanics. I still never did, even when I was in the big leagues. But even when I was in college, like Stolte never messed with me. He didn't try to change me too much. He just kind of let me throw the low three-quarter sidearm kind of angle that I had and just, you know, just kind of let me be. And I just kind of grew and he would just help me with a few things here and there if I got off kilter. But, you know, Powers was more with the hitters, the fielders. And then, you know, since I was a pitcher, it's like we would just go run our poles and go throw bullpens and go shag. And that's pretty much all we did.
So as you started to grow into your body, first of all, I would think that any pants that you were wearing constantly became floods that you probably couldn't fit into any pants as fast as you were growing. Were you just eating a ton? Did your body just naturally grow? Did you just totally just attack the weight room or how did you put on weight and put on velocity and start to develop into the man that you became?
I mean, everybody with a fast metabolism back then, I mean, I was just eating a bunch of food, but then as far as like trying to gain weight and my goal was always to try to put on like 10 or 15 pounds like every year. So, you know, back in the day, it was at Weight Gainer 2000, you know, trying to drink those shakes. Mm-hmm. You know, a funny story, I think when I was in high school or maybe junior college, because I was still living at home, is my mom would actually cook me or bake me like a box cake, like a cake, mm-hmm. like vanilla cake with chocolate frosting. And she would put it like in the kitchen and nobody was allowed to eat it. And I would have like a huge slice of cake like every day. And I'd finish the cake in like a week and she'd make me another one. So I would like, I was trying to eat like Weight Gainer stuff. I was like eating cake. I was like, I mean, it's probably not the right way to gain weight nowadays, but I was so skinny, it would just burn it right off. So it's like, it's funny because I have a son that's 12 and he's super skinny and we're like, cake a week, let's get him a cake a week, you know? But I mean, as I got older and I went to Nevada, I mean, that's when I was first really introduced to the weight room as well.
Okay.
And so I think as my career evolved into the minor leagues, I took the weight room a lot more serious and tried to gain weight through obviously eating supplements, you know, shakes and stuff, but healthier, and then also lifting. And I just kept getting stronger and stronger and stronger. But I didn't start throwing hard till my senior year of college.
So you didn't get drafted after your junior year, right?
I got drafted as a sophomore from junior college by the Blue Jays in like the 52nd or 53rd round. I don't even think there's that many rounds anymore. And it was more or less like a draft and follow. They wanted to see how you could do. Back then they were allowed to draft like that, and then they could try to sign you the next year. And you know, that didn't happen. So then I went undrafted my junior year. And my junior year, I was like 80, I think. Well, after my sophomore year, I went and played summer baseball. And that year I was around like 89 to 91. It was like the hardest I had ever thrown. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm throwing 90 miles an hour. This is great, you know? And then I kind of hurt my elbow. I like tweaked my Tommy John ligament, and so they sent me home. And so then I went to Nevada the next year as a junior, and I was like down to like 87, 88, 89 the whole year. And then my junior year, I didn't want to go play this intense summer league. So I went with Ryan Church, Brian Schultz, me, and there might have been another guy. I'm not sure if we had another teammate out there. And we went and played in Santa Barbara for the Foresters. And a lot of guys would go out there, have fun, live in Santa Barbara for the summer. And I was just throwing harder that summer. I don't know why. And then I come back in the for spring ball in my senior year. And Inglet and all those guys are like, dude, Chad, you're throwing hard, man. I'm like, I don't know, maybe 91. I used to throw that hard. And I think like the second practice they had the gun out, they were telling me I was throwing like 94. And I'm like, dude, no, I hadn't even hit 92 or 93. I'm like, quit lying to me. There's no chance I'm hitting 94. And sure enough, I jumped like 3 to 5 miles an hour. Just no clue how. But it was to the point where when I got drafted, I was getting ready for the minor league season. I had Stolte pull the gun out when I was throwing my bullpens to make sure I was still throwing hard, because I thought I was going to like lose it, because I'd never thrown that hard before.
Yeah. So much of baseball now is about velocity, and we could probably spend hours and hours discussing that. But I'm curious just how much you had to learn how to pitch when you didn't have velocity, and how that helped you once you did get velocity later in your career.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a big factor, being able to locate your fastball. That's main thing for me. I mean, I was stay down in the zone, locate your fastball, get ground balls. And if you can get to two strikes, and go ahead and you can try to strike them out. You know, I was never this overpowering, dominant kid like my whole life. So I had to learn, you know, to locate, you know, throw the ball where I wanted it to, being able to change speeds. And that's kind of what I teach my sons right now. As I said, you know, everybody wants to go fast, 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 fast. But if you don't know where the ball's going, it doesn't matter. You know, I tell my 12-year-old, I said, look, if you can throw 118 miles an hour, that might look cool. But what if you walk 7 people in a row? Who cares if you throw that hard? You know, you still have to be able to locate. So I really, really believe that, I think locating your fastball is the number one thing, and everything else can play off of that.
So when you were a starter with Nevada, it was you and Daryl Rasner, who also made it to the major leagues. He pitched in Japan. And so you guys were like the big 1-2 punch for the Wolfpack. Describe your relationship with Daryl and kind of how you guys might've fed off each other, or just what it was like, the two of you guys.
Man, Daryl was a stud, man. He came in his freshman year and just impressed everybody right away. I still talk to him this day. I mean, he lives out in Reno. And so whenever I go out there for the Bobby Dolan dinner, or go visit some of my buddies, we always hook up and have some beers and stuff like that. So it was just fun watching a local kid come in as a freshman. And I mean, I think he won 14 games or something like that year. So I was hoping he wasn't going to win more than me. I was trying to be the guy, you know, but he just kind of showed me up. But it was fun. I mean, he had a nasty curveball and really hard fastball from the get go. And he just had that bulldog mentality as a freshman and didn't really let anything intimidate him. And usually, you know, the conference that we were in back then, I mean, we had Cal State Fullerton, Long Beach State, us. I mean, we played some premier schools and he didn't back down from any of them.
Yeah. You guys were in the Big West back then. What's some of your favorite just team memories? You know, you guys went to the regionals, I'm pretty sure, both those years. You had almost exact records. They see 38 and 21 year, 38 and 19 the next year. Just some of your biggest, funnest memories of those Nevada teams.
I mean, that's just what we were, man. We were a team. I mean, we did everything together. I mean, we would win together. We'd lose together. We'd go drink beers at the bars together. We'd get in trouble for drinking at the bars together. I remember there was one time, I think it might have, I'm guessing it was a Sunday because I usually would throw on Fridays. So it was, you know, I didn't have to pitch the next 2 days, so I could go out and have my fair share of cocktails and not worry about anything. But the rest of the team had to play, and I think we got stomped on like Sunday, and the whole team went out Saturday. And so we showed up to the field Monday for our workouts, and there was a chain on the fence, and there was a note that said, you know, bring your track shoes tomorrow, you know, field's closed, you guys are running. And I guess the owner of the establishment that we were all at on Saturday had told Powers that the reason why we played terrible was because the whole team was out and partying or something like that. So I think on Tuesday we just got just buried into the ground running, you know, to prove a point that we shouldn't do that. And it didn't work. We probably just went out the next weekend as well anyway. So we just kept winning. Who cares? You know, yeah. If you're winning, it doesn't matter what you're doing, right? Isn't that the old saying? It's like, if you're winning, who cares, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, those teams, man, we had so much fun and just hanging out and just spending that quality time as a team just made us even more. You know, it wasn't just on-the-field stuff. We were always off the field with each other, too.
Mm-hmm. So a number of guys that you were teammates with in college ended up playing professionally. Ryan Church, you were teammates with him, both with the Wolfpack and with the Diamondbacks. You got to have some Ryan Church stories from over the years from your time as a college kids and as a pro players.
Yeah. I mean, I love Churchy. He's you know, he was a great player. I feel like if he didn't hurt his arm too, he could have been a great pitcher, but great outfielder. He could hit, had a pretty swing from the left side. I think he's the only person that probably missed a big league opening day start because his toe was hurt and he pulled himself out of the lineup. He can go ahead and answer that question on that one. Out of starting opening day, and I think he pulled himself because he had a sore toe or something like that. That was in the big leagues. But, yeah, I mean, in college, he had a lot of migraine stuff going on. So there'd be times where he'd be running in from the outfield and he's like, dude, it's going, I'm getting tunnel vision, getting black, and he'd get these migraines. So he dealt with that his whole life. And then I think he just had like three concussions, like back to back to back in the big leagues. I think he slid into second and got kneed in the head, dove for a ball and hit the wall. And I think that's what kind of derailed him in the big leagues, was just his migraines and his headaches. But I think if he didn't have those problems, he could have easily played 10 years. He was awesome.
Man, that's terrible.
Yeah. I mean, health plays a big, I mean, I'm lucky. I mean, to this day, I still tell everybody, like, as many games as I pitched, I have no scars on the right side of my body, elbow, shoulder, no surgeries.
That's remarkable.
So I always tell everybody, God bless me with a great shoulder and elbow and a terrible body.
What about Lyle Overbay? You guys overlapped 1 year. You guys squared off in the major leagues quite a few times as well. Tell me about Lyle Overbay.
I couldn't get him out. I couldn't get him out in college, and I couldn't get him out in the big leagues. Like, we would play in spring, and we'd play against each other, you know, so we would scrimmage. And I think he got the hit off me every time. I threw him everything I had, he'd get a hit off me. And then – you know, so I mean, I knew he was a great player. I think like in short season, he had like 100 RBIs or something his first year in the minor leagues, which is amazing. Cause I think he only played like 60 or 70 games. To have 100 RBIs was ridiculous. And then, you know, we only faced each other a few times. I think he had two homers off me in the big leagues. And believe it or not, if you ever get Lyle on here, you can ask him. I think he was with Milwaukee and he hit a homer off me and it went onto the concourse. And I think it literally bounced and hit his wife as she was like walking on the concourse in the outfield. Like he literally hit his own wife with a home run ball that he hit off me. I think that's a true story. Yeah, that's what I, every time I hear Lyle Overbay, I'm like, oh man, he hit that bomb off me. And I think he hit his wife with the home run ball.
So let's get into a little bit about your pro career. You were drafted in 2000 as a starter. You were mostly a starter in the minors. You get called up. It's 4 years later when you finally get called up for the first time as a reliever. What helped make the switch? Because let's be honest, at least looking at your numbers, you struggled as a starting pitcher. What was it about relieving that clicked for you?
It was my two-seam fastball, to be honest with you. So even in college, I was four-seam, trying to locate the ball really well, trying to overpower guys. And, I mean, I threw well in the minor leagues, but I really only – I tell everybody I had 2.5 pitches. I had a fastball, a slider, and like half of a changeup. And if you're going to be a starter, you need at least 3 pitches, at least 3 pitches. And I just didn't quite ever have it. I always had like 2.5. And so but I always saw myself as I wanted to be the number one guy, number two starter. That's how I wanted to be. I was just, you know, super stingy and hard-headed. And, you know, I just never got my changeup down. Even at the end of my career, I would still mess with it, but it was never really that good. And so we got into Double-A. It was my second year of Double-A. I had to repeat Double-A. And I had a pitching coach. His name was Joe Sluzarski. Mm-hmm. And I'm throwing a bullpen. And he's like, Chad, you ever thrown a two-seamer? And I'm like, no. He goes, well, why not? I said, well, it just moves too much. You know, being some dumb 21-year-old, 22-year-old kid, you know, it just moves too much. I can't locate it. He's like, what do you mean it moves too much? Just do me a favor. Throw me a few two-seamers in the bullpen. Let me see what it does. So me being an idiot, I just, you know, drag my arm off to the side and open up and ball takes off. He's like, just throw it normal. Don't do anything like that. Just throw it just like your four-seamer. So my four-seamer always had a little bit of tail on it anyways. I could never throw a ball straight. And so I hold this thing two-seam, and I guess it just takes off. And the catcher's like looking at me, and he's like, throw me a few more. So I throw a few more, and he goes, Qualls, you're never throwing a four-seamer ever again your whole entire life. You're throwing everything two-seam. I'm like, all right. So he's like, next start, I want you to just set up right down the middle and just throw all two seamers. I said, okay. I think I broke like 7 bats that next game, had like a ton of ground balls. And I was like, this is pretty cool, you know? And so just over the next year, I started just being able to locate my two seamer. And that's when they turned me into a reliever. And I was in the big leagues a year later. So literally I learned my two seamer. And 1 year later, I was in the big leagues.
You probably were at big league spring training at some point, but you get called up. And I mean, that Astro team, you got Bagwell, Biggio, Ausmus, Jeff Kent, Lance Berkman, Carlos Beltran, Roger Clemens, who won the Cy Young that year, Roy Oswalt, who was third in Cy Young, Andy Pettit, Brad Lidge is the closer. That clubhouse is loaded. What's it like for you when you walk in and here I am going to make my major league debut and there's all these future Hall of Famers around you?
I tried to hide and be quiet. I didn't want to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, because back then the culture was a little different. You know, they'd kind of get on you if you were a rookie and you were kind of loud and boisterous, you know, they would just, you know, wear you out, pound you into the ground, make you do some stuff. And so I just tried to mind my P's and Q's and know when I could talk and hang out with some guys and just kind of was just really quiet. And I'm sarcastic, fun type of guy. But in that environment, I was just like hush, hush, try to stick to my business and just tried to earn my stripes through what I did on the field. And then, you know, let me into their circle once, you know, they felt like maybe I was, you know, good enough to be able to be a big leaguer or what they thought. And so I just kind of just watched how everybody worked and, you know, just hung out. And like I said, I just stayed in my locker and was just really, really quiet.
Who'd you gravitate to or what older relievers kind of helped you out or kind of like, you know, showed you the ropes and kind of gave you some ideas about stretching or throwing or just what it means to be, you know, a big leaguer?
Well, that was so I had it when I was in Triple A and they were transitioning me into a relief pitcher. They had signed this guy named Russ Springer. No idea who this guy was. Apparently, he already had 9 years in the big leagues. I didn't even know who he was. Just this Louisiana Cajun backwoods guy that hunted squirrels. I had no idea that you hunted squirrels back then. I was just this California kid. And so I just thought he was just this old dude playing Triple A. Well, I get called up and then he gets called up and then he apparently took me under his wing and they told him, hey, you know, when you get to the next level with Qualsy, I need you guys I need you to show him the ropes. He still has no, I've been in the bullpen like 2 weeks. I have no idea how, what I'm doing, and I'm in the big leagues. And so he kind of took me under his wing, and he was like, hey, every fifth inning, we're going to go stretch. Hey, just let you know these types of situations you've been pitching. And it's like the sixth inning, seventh inning, we're winning the game by a couple of runs. He's like, Qualsy, I bet you they're going to call here in a little bit. You're probably going to get up and start getting loose here. And I'm like, how do you know that? There's no chance, you know, which that's easy now knowing the game. But back then I had no idea. Sure enough, phone rings. Hey, Chad, get loose. I'm like, man, you might see the future. This is crazy. So, I mean, Russ Springer is big guy that really helped me understand how to prepare in the bullpen, how to read the situations of the game, so that you can mentally start getting ready to throw, even though you're not even up throwing yet. You just can kind of see how the game's going, the pitch counts on the pitchers and your situation. So I still talk to Russ here and there, you know, now and then, ask him if he still hunts squirrels and hanging out. And I think he is.
Compare, I mean, look, everyone's dream is to make the major leagues. You make the major leagues, and then that same year, you get added to the Astros postseason roster. Kind of compare and contrast the pride in A, reaching the major leagues, but B, as a rookie, making the Astros postseason roster.
Yeah, I mean, I was just so young, and I didn't even know any better that I was just like, yeah, I mean, I've been thrown in the pen. Of course I'm on the team. Like, I didn't know that, like, they could just take you on and put you off. I just knew that I was throwing, and I think it helped me that I was so naive at that point in time in my career that when I was thrown in the postseason and against Pujols in his prime, Jim Edmonds, because, I mean, we had so many battles with the Braves and so many battles with the Cardinals, because I think both times those playoffs, it was Braves first and the Cardinals, Braves first and Cardinals. And, I mean, I had no idea. I just knew that I'd come in, pitch, do good. I mean, I wanted to pitch every single game. Like, we would have, I mean, my arm would be a little bit sore, and I'd be like, I could pitch. And so I think being that young and that naive, like, really helped me. Like, even in the World Series, I was just like, this is pretty cool. There's like no other games going on. I wasn't nervous at all. Like, it was almost like when I got to the playoffs, like later in my career, I kind of realized the stage that it was. I'm like, I can't believe, like, when I was that young, it didn't faze me at all. It was crazy.
I was reading this story about how, and I remember this watching about how you and Brad Lidge and Dan Wheeler, you guys basically all looked the same, right? You guys all had like goatees. You're all like the seventh, eighth, ninth inning guys. What was it? I mean, you guys looked like brothers. What was it about that trio of guys late in games for the Astros where you guys all looked the same and came in and you guys all just dominated?
I mean, we were just all goofballs, man. Like, when you sit down in the bullpen with each other for every single game for that long of a period, you only have you're seven or eight guys in the pen. I mean, you gravitate towards each other. You have great relationships. So, and you know, we all rooted for each other. I've had teammates in the past that if I was the eighth inning guy, that seventh inning guy wanted you to fail so he could take over your job. Or if I was the ninth inning guy and he was the eighth inning guy, he'd want to climb up the totem pole, where we didn't care who threw or who had an off day, or if I got the outs in the seventh, or if Wheeler got him in the eighth. Like, we would flip flop. As long as we won the game and we were winning and moving on, nobody cared where they threw. And I think that just created an even bigger friendship because everybody pulled for everybody. Even the guy that would never pitch, never complained in that bullpen. Like, everybody wanted everybody to succeed. And I think that's huge key factors in a successful bullpen, just because nowadays, I mean, you know, you're going to make more money if you're the closer, you're going to make second amount of money if you're the eighth inning guy, and it goes down the totem pole. But back then we didn't care. We just wanted to win games, and we became, you know, yet again, off the field, drinking beers, hanging out, you know, and just having a good time.
You mentioned about the Braves and the Cardinals facing them in the playoffs. I have to ask you about 2005. 18 innings was the clincher. You beat the Braves in four games. Again, 18 innings was the clincher. You pitched the ninth and the 10th inning, and there was this comeback where your team scored four in the eighth to get it close, and you pitched a scoreless ninth, and then the Astros got a run in the ninth inning that tied it, and then you came back for a scoreless 10th, and then it went all the way to 18 innings where Clemens went the last three innings. Describe for me your memories of pitching in that game in that 18-inning legendary game.
It's, I mean, some of those are so long ago that I don't remember it a ton. And then like, it'll come on MLB Network and I'll watch it. But I just remember just going out there, getting my outs And then the rest of it might be a little bit of a blur because sometimes when we were done in the bullpen, we might have indulged in a few adult beverages after our outings. And so trying to get a rally going. And so some of it's a little bit hazy, but I remember that I was on the rail too once Chris Burke hit that homer. And it's like, and when you've seen enough homers from the Crawford boxes, but back then we called it the Biggio boxes because that's all Craig would do was just try to hit them into those little boxes. So we called them the Biggio boxes. And so as soon as it went off his bat, we knew that it was like loud enough and hard enough and high enough. We knew it was like a walk-off as soon as it hit. So like even right now, I'm getting the chills again from it just because it was just an amazing game in general, because I think that was the game that I think Berkman hit like a huge home run. I think Ausmus ended up hitting like a huge home run, and Ausmus never hits home runs. And then, you know, just to go 18 innings and win it like that in that fashion and be able to be part of that game was awesome.
And then to finally beat the Cardinals. I mean, even when you guys were making the playoffs, you guys were 13 back, 11 back. They beat you the year before in the National League Championship Series. What did it mean to finally beat them and go on to the World Series?
It was good because I remember in 04 when they beat us, I didn't pitch that game that they won. And I was sitting out in the bullpen and the confetti and all that stuff was flying and the fans are throwing beers and the place is going nuts. And I was standing on the rail just trying to soak it all in because I knew the season was over, but I also just loved the environment that I was in. And I knew that I wanted to get back there and try to be those people on the field. So that next year, yet again, we come out and beat the Braves again and we get going against St. Louis, and everybody makes a big deal about the Lidge and the Pujols home run that I think was in game five, maybe. I think it was game five. And I mean, if you look at Lidge's statistics against Pujols, it was ridiculous. I mean, he would strike him out and this is in his prime. And so Brad just made a bad pitch, gave up a massive homer. They just win the game. Now we got to fly back to St. Louis. Funny story on that note is that as we're flying out, we take off, we kind of reach our cruising altitude, and Ausmus, who is very sarcastic, goes up to the pilot and he tells him, hey, when you get to the cruising altitude, you need to do this certain thing. So we're all back there playing cards, having a few beers, and the pilot comes on the intercom and he says, hey guys, just want to let you know we're on our way to St. Louis. If you look out the right side of the airplane, you'll still see the ball that Pujols hit off a Lidge. It's going through orbit right now. And he tilts the plane to the right even. And Brad was, he was livid. But I mean, he got over it. Ausmus went over there, told him. I mean, that's just the kind of team we were. You know, we just joked with each other. And sure enough, game six came on. We beat him. We went to the World Series. So yeah, great story.
How close were you to Brad Lidge when the pilot said that? Were you like right next to him to see his reaction? Or
I think, I was close enough to see him just turn just and he's a guy that you can't joke with because he goes from 0 to 100. Mm-hmm. Like I would throw like seeds on him and then he would want to throw like hot coffee on me. Like it's like that quick, you okay. know? So like there was a time on the plane where I think Wheeler was throwing a pillow at him because you know back in the day you used to get those pillows like on flights, and so we would just chuck them at people and then hide so they didn't know who threw them. So Lidge gets smoked by a pillow. He literally comes up and he just got done eating the appetizer that we had. It was like crab claws and like cocktail sauce. Literally took his whole plate and like tried to throw it on Wheeler, but he had a blanket and he blocked it, which made him even more pissed that he didn't get this. He was throwing cocktail sauce on this guy's suit for throwing a pillow at him. I'm like, Brad, what are you doing? And so, yeah, but I mean, he was fuming. But then once he found out that it was Ausmus who had like 15 years in the big leagues, he was like, all right, I have to let that one go.
Yeah. So, yeah. You're proud of your career ERA in the World Series, aren't you?
It's the only run I gave up.
You should be proud though, right?
That's what I tell everybody. I said, Wheeler shouldn't have left all those guys on base. Conerico was my only run. The other ones were Wheeler's.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's still a chair out there in at U.S. Cellular that I think that's the commemorative like Conerico World Series chair. It's a different color out there, and I said that's my stupid Grand Slam World Series chair that's out there.
But what did it mean to you? You mentioned earlier about how you really were naive, and that helped you. By the second year in the playoffs, and you get to the World Series, just looking back on it now, what did it mean to you to be a part of the most important baseball games taking place?
It was awesome. It really was. I mean, you know, like I said, I wanted to pitch in every game. So I knew when that situation was coming up too. And I knew I was going to come and get, although my spot had been passed in the seventh, once Wheeler was pitching, I knew that when he was starting to get into a jam that I was probably going to try to help get out of it. So, you know, I wanted to be there. And even looking back now, it was like, man, it's just awesome being able to pitch in those situations. I watch World Series games all the time and watch how guys attack the zone and just know that, you know, it's you know, people play their whole entire career. I mean, that was the only World Series Biggio and Bagwell and those guys got to play in, and they played for 20 years. So I never took anything for granted. You know, even giving up that first pitch grand slam to Canerco, I think the very next game we went to extra innings again. I think I threw three shutout innings that game. So, you know, just kind of showed my grit and tenacity to kind of get back out there and not let it bug me. So, you know, super, super special.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to get into this because this year's Nevada team has had some nice come from behind victories, but they've also had some gut-wrenching losses where they've lost, you know, late games, given up leads. For you, how did you deal with failure individually, collectively as a team? What were some of your, you know, the things that you did to get over giving up a big home run or just, you know, no one feels worse than the guy on the mound, whether it's your fault or not. There's a lot of things that go into a loss, but, you know, what did you do? How did you deal with failure?
Man, I took it hard on myself. I really did. I mean, I expected myself to get the job done every time. And, you know, if I didn't get it done, I was more disappointed in myself because I know that I should have done better. And it's weird because then when I would be successful, I would just be like, all right, yeah, I was supposed to do that. But then I wouldn't do it and I'd be pissed off at myself. But I was able to let it go because I wanted to go back out there and prove myself the next day. Like I didn't ever really dwell on it. I would just, it kind of ticked me off the rest of that night. You know, a lot of people could rinse it off at the field and leave it there. I took it to the hotel and I was upset for hours upon hours. But when I would wake up that next day, I really wanted to get out there and I was fighting to get out there. And it's just something that as a reliever, you know, you have to have a short memory. I mean, I know people say it all the time. You have to have a short memory just to be a relief pitcher. Cause I mean, you can go out there and give up the game one day. And then the next day you're out there again in that situation. So deep breath and just trust in yourself. I mean, you know that you've done it before, so you can do it again. It's just a matter of doing it. Yet again, Russ Springer, the guy that took me under his wing, he noticed that I would be a lot more hard on myself all the time after games like that. And he'd always tell me, he's like, look, this game's not easy. If this game was easy, you know, do you think, you know, so-and-so would be behind a computer? Do you think so-and-so would have that job? They would all be a baseball player. If the game was easy, why would somebody choose to not be, you know what I mean? It's the greatest sport ever. And so he's like, you know, we just make the game look easy from time to time, but it's not. So sometimes it'll just humble us, bring us back down to earth and start back from scratch.
I remember when I was first starting as a reporter, the first team that I covered was the San Francisco Giants, and Rob Nen was the closer then. And Nen was a guy where if he gave up the lead, if he got a blown save, he would be standing at his locker waiting for the press to come in so that he could immediately do the postmortem. And if he got the save, you couldn't find him. And I remember some older reporters telling me, don't just talk to the closer when they blow a save. Make sure that you talk to them after wins. And so I remember thinking like, okay, I need to do this. But I couldn't find Rob. But that was by design. And this kind of goes to what you were just saying, that he didn't think that it was a big deal when he got the win. And that's when he would be in the training room. That's when he would be on the bike or whatever he would do. But after losses, he would stand right there and make sure that he was there. And so I'm wondering if you could just touch on just sort of like accountability, whether that's to your teammates or to the press or to the fans, about what it's like and how hard that is in those moments.
I think huge accountability. And I learned that from Brad Lidge. I watched him, you know, when he was at the pinnacle of his career. And then when he went through one of his rough spots, and he was always there for the media, and the media was always a little bit gentler on the guys that would be accessible. And so throughout my career, I mean, if I messed up and I blew the game, I know everybody wants to come talk to me and ask me questions about what pitch I threw, what happened and everything else. I know that's coming. And so I would, you know, I'd get in the shower or I would just wait for the locker room. They'd kind of all gather around and I'd answer all the questions. And I'd be as polite as I could or as pissed off as I could, but I'd answer everybody's questions and be accessible and be as transparent as I possibly could. And I think the more athletes are like that, the easier the media is going to be on that athlete, because they're going to respect you letting the reporter do their job. And so I was lucky throughout my career that I think in most cities the media was pretty easy on me, just because I was accessible and easy to work with. And I've learned that from Brad Lidge, watching him you know, take his licks and stand up there and answer the questions from the media, because I mean, that's your guys' job. You know, you got to go out there and report the news. And if something crappy happens, I got to answer to that. And, you know, there's no reason to hide from it. If you hide from it, then it's just going to become a bigger story. So, you know, it's like when I fist pumped and I fell off the mound. I mean, I didn't run from it. I just sat there and I was like, well, rolled my ankle, fell over. It's pretty excited. What do you want me to do? And so I kind of just fessed up to it and lived up to it. And was like, no big deal. I'm not going to hide from it. Pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah. So if you don't mind, for people who know that as I do, it was really funny. But for those who don't know what you're talking about, if you don't mind, kind of explain this fist bump that led to you falling down.
So there's a big backstory to it too. So like I had to sign a minor league deal to get to Miami, which means I had to go to spring training, make the team, and I was getting older. So I knew that, you know, if I didn't have a good year, then I would probably have to try to prove myself again next year, or I wasn't going to get a contract or whatever. So that whole year, I was like super intense trying to get another contract the next year, because I was on a 1-year deal. It was late in the game in the 8th inning, and it was a 1-run game. And so last thing I want to do is blow a save, give up some runs. So that year I was trying to be super selfish. I want to have great statistics. I want to have great numbers in holds or saves, whatever I was getting, because I was fighting for next year's contract. So I'd given up a leadoff triple and I'd like gotten the next two guys out. So now there's two outs and still the guy on third in a 1-run lead. And so like 5 pitches before that, I landed in the dirt and I had like tweaked my ankle, but you know, I was like, whatever, I'll be all right. And so I ended up striking him out, and knowing in that situation that I left the guy on third, I didn't blow the game, I didn't give up any runs, I got my hold, I fist pumped because I was super stoked and excited. And in doing so, then my ankle fully gave out and I just went down, and then I popped up and I was like, oh crap. I was like, dude, that really just happened. I'm like, whatever, it doesn't matter. I'm in Miami. There's only like 7,000 people here. No one's going to see it. Totally not realizing it's on TV and then it's going to go on YouTube and everything else. And so I popped up and all the young kids in Miami, like all the rookies and stuff, were just, dude, they loved it. Like next day they had like snipers set up in the stands and like all this caution tape around the mound. And I had to tape my ankle the next like 2.5 weeks. Like I had like a severely like sprained ankle, but I couldn't tell anybody because I was like, there's no chance I'm going to go on the DL for like rolling my ankle and like falling down. So I just taped the crap out of it for the next 2 weeks and just kept pitching.
So you had a good consistent run with the Astros and with the Diamondbacks. And then you get to this point in your career, you just kind of become like this hired gun or this hired arm where, you know, you got traded twice in 1 month at one point. And as you mentioned, you're kind of pitching for your next year's contract. I know that some guys like Octavio Dotel and Edwin Jackson, they've kind of just embraced the number of teams that they played on. But for you, how did you cope with, okay, what team am I on? And, you know, where am I going to be this year? And am I going to get traded yet again when July comes around? Do you still get PTSD when July comes around about getting traded or anything?
I kind of got used to it. I mean, I started to embrace the fact that I wanted to try to break the record for the most teams, you know, played on, which I think it was Dotel. Now I think it is Edwin Jackson. But I was like, you know what? It yet again goes back to Russ Springer. He even called me and he was like, look, you get past a certain time in your career and you're a right-handed reliever, you're exactly what you said. He used the words a hired gun. You're basically a hired gun for the teams. And, you know, they might only want you for a year and then you're done. And then they might go find somebody else. He goes, but that doesn't matter. He's like, you're still wanted. You're still useful to the younger kids that can help out. So don't get upset that you only get these 1-year deals. You know, you're still wanted. So I kind of embraced it. I knew it was going to happen. You know, like you said, I didn't get my first 2-year contract until I re-signed with the Astros, which was my 9th year in the big leagues. So I was year to year for like 9 years. So I finally got this 2-year contract. I was like, dude, I feel like Mike Trout right now. I got like a multi-year deal right now. I'm good. So, you know, I just kind of embraced it. You know, every trade deadline that came around again, I was like, well, my name's getting thrown around. No big deal. Cause you know, I had teammates that said, look, if your name is being, used in trade rumors, and that's a good thing. Don't be scared of that, because if your name's being thrown around in trade rumors, that means that everybody wants you. So that means you have a job. So don't be scared of getting traded. That means that everybody wants you and they want you to be in their bullpen. So I was like, well, that must be a good thing. So I always took it as a compliment that I'd be in the trade rumors, because from a long time ago, everyone said that if your name's being thrown around, then everybody wants you. And if they want you, then you got a job.
You recorded 74 saves in your career. Is there one or two that stand out that's most memorable because of either the situation or the hitters that you faced, or because it was the first or the last, or any of those most meaningful to you?
I don't think any of them are more meaningful. I mean, the first one was always pretty cool, but that one I think was against the Pirates, and we were in extra innings, and literally I think they used everybody else in the bullpen and they just kept blowing the game, tying it. And I was like the last one down there. And they're like, all right, who do we have left? Oh shit, we got Qualls. I was like, all right. So, I mean, my first one, I remember it was like that, 'cause I was literally like the last one like left in the bullpen, 'cause I was still so young. There was another save I remember. I don't remember if it was the Tigers, but it was Jack Hanahan was a hitter, but I think I was with the Diamondbacks. Maybe he was with the A's. I don't remember. Anyways, I couldn't throw a strike to save my life. I mean, I was spiking fastballs. I think I'd walk the bases loaded and I had one out, and all of a sudden, not to call out old Jack, but I was like, oh dude, I can get this guy to hit a ground ball. I can get out of this thing and win it. So he steps up to the plate and I take a deep breath and I'm like, dude, Chad, you can do this. And so I told my middle infielders, I'm like, dude, you better roll this shit. Like, you better roll it. And sure enough, like first or second pitch, ground ball right to shortstop, roll a double play. And I was like, oh my God, I think I threw six strikes the whole inning and like got the save. So that one was a big one that stood out just because I had nothing that day. I could not find the strike zone to save my life. And then I think later on in my career when I was with Houston, because I never really fully always had the closer's role. I'd always start out as like the eighth inning, seventh inning guy, and I would throw the ball well, and then they would just kind of implement me in there, and then I kind of close that way. But there was a game against Anaheim when I was getting up there about 34, maybe 35 years of age, and Trout was, you know, the big deal out there, and Pujols was still a threat back then. And I remember I had to come in the game to relieve somebody, and there was one out, a couple guys on, two-run lead, and I had to face Trout and Pujols. And I was like, oh, man, this – I mean, even as a reliever, I was like, God, this sucks. But I don't know what Trout did. I would like to say I punched him out, but I have no idea. But I know that I got Pujols to pop up to the infield, and I was just super excited to kind of get those two out right then and there to lock the game down.
What's it like just, you know, those handshakes after the game? We mentioned earlier, you know, what happens when you don't get the job done, but just, you know, you get the last out and everyone smiles and you line up and you shake hands or you bump fist. I mean, what are those emotions like?
Oh, it's just relief. I mean, it's the best feeling ever. Adam LaRoche, another one of my buddies, ex-teammate from back in the Diamondbacks, he had a great saying. He was like, we don't play this game for the feeling that you get while you play the game. We play this game for the feeling you get when you're done and you do good. Like you, it's that sense of relief and proudness of yourself for getting the job done. That's like the best feeling in the world. But when you're in the midst of that battle, man, it is so stressful. It's like some people might say they have a blast while they're on the mound or while they're hitting, but I mean, I was so locked in that I never had fun. I was never worried. I was just trying to hone in on my one task, was to get that guy out. And then once the day was over and my job was done, then I could take a deep breath and look back at what I'd accomplished that day or that hitter, and then like be super happy about it. But in the midst of that battle, it's just, it's grinding it.
When you would get called in, okay, you're warming up in the bullpen. Okay. They say, okay, bring in Qualls. When you were going from the bullpen out to the mound, would you jog? Would you sprint? Would you try to clear the mechanism as they said in the movie? Would you, like, what would be like your routine in those moments when you know, okay, here we go, it's showtime?
It was, you know, I'd take the last few sips of a water bottle, drop it on the ground or throw it on the ground or whatever. Take a deep breath as soon as I left that gate. And then when I would hit the grass to the outfield, I would just kind of just normal trot it in. And then when I would hit the grass to the infield, I'd start walking again, catch my breath, because I was probably out of shape. So I could warm up, and I would just game face on. I mean, I was really good at, you know, being able to joke around and have fun. But once I got between those lines, I knew that it's like, it's go time. And I just would focus all my concentration on whether it was one out, two outs, three outs, two innings. I would try to pitch as hard as I could, as best I could, for as long as I could, and just be mentally tired as I was done with that outing, whether however long it was. And so, you know, I would just tell myself, you know, you got this, just take a deep breath, throw the way that you can throw, another great saying someone told me was, look, after you release that ball, you can't do anything. You don't know where it's going to get hit. You can't control how the fielders are going to do. The only thing you can control is try to throw the best pitch that you could possibly throw in that situation and execute. After that, you can't do anything. So once I stopped trying to control every other factor, you know, it made it a lot easier. I mean, if I threw a really good pitch down and away and the guy got a hit, you know, I'd take my hat off and say, hey, that's a great swing, you know, and I would have that mentality on the mound, you know, knowing that I executed my pitch, you know, and he got a hit. Well, what else could I have done? I couldn't have done anything different. So I wouldn't be upset at that. I would be upset if I didn't execute a pitch, left a slider up, fastball over the middle, and they pounded it in the gap, then I'd be upset. But if I executed my pitch, I wasn't mad at myself.
After 14 years in the major leagues, how do you know that it's time to move on and retire?
I just started to get a feeling to where I just knew, you know, my arm still felt good. My back was getting a little sore here and there, but it's weird. I mean, you kind of realize it. I knew that I was getting obviously up there in age, and I knew the game was getting younger and younger, but there was a point in that year when I was with the Rockies and I was like, you know what, if they release me tomorrow, I'm okay with it. Like I was somehow at ease. And I think I could say that because I played so long and I feel like I gave the game as much as I could give it. I'm sure I could have gone out there still and pitched, but I wouldn't have been nearly the person that I was at the beginning and the middle of my career. But I think there's just a feeling inside everybody that you don't have as much fire as you used to have. I mean, it's weird. It's just a feeling that you kind of get and you kind of know. And so when the time came, I mean, I even called my wife, and I think she was cleaning the house. And my son answered. I said, hey, put mom on. And he was like, well, mom's vacuuming. I said, well, put mom on, you know, because I just got released. And so she answers the phone. I said, hey, I said, Tara, I just got released, you know, so I don't know what's going on. She's like, oh, okay, when are you coming home? Like she was so happy she was going to have like a full-time husband and like, yeah, you know, parent around, you know. You know? She was just so happy because she was like, thank God, it's about time, you know. But so, I mean, and even saying bye to all my friends, I was like, you know what, it's fine. You know, and to this day, I'm proud of my career. I took most pride in taking the ball every day whenever I was healthy. That's why the game's pitch that you said, like, that's what I take my pride in, was the fact that, you know, even when I wasn't 100%, I would, you know, pitching coach would come out, be like, hey, can we use you for an inning? I'm like, I'm good. If you need me, I'll throw. If you need me, I'll throw. And, you know, I'm sure I could have probably thrown a lot better in other situations if I might have taken a day here or a day there and really rested up and not thrown 3 days in a row. I mean, there were multiple times in my career I threw 4 days in a row. You know, nowadays a lot of guys will throw 2 days in a row, and the organization wants them to have a day off. You know, it's rare to find guys that go 3 days in a row because the teams don't want them to. They want them to stay healthy and fresh. And, you know, back when I was a rookie and even the middle of my career, I mean, you never said no. You know, it was like, nope, I'm good. I'm good. You know, and I just said that every day. I said, no, I'm good. I can pitch.
You mentioned earlier about your sons who play baseball. What do you do these days? How do you stay busy? What's a normal week or a normal month like for you and your family?
Man, I'm in the thick of it. I have a 12-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 4-year-old. So I assistant coach with my 12-year-old select baseball team because I don't want to ever like full-time coach that stuff. And then I also assistant coach my 7-year-old's coach pitch team. So
are you one of the coaches who pitches?
I am. Yeah, I am. I try to get lit up by 7 and 8 year olds. Yes. Weekly.
Okay.
And then I help out with my 12-year-old's team. I help with the kids with pitching, and I'll have them throw bullpens and stuff like that. And my daughter, who's 4, she's just a handful in general as well. So it's like, I tell everybody I'm super busy. I don't even know how I could work. And my wife always tells me, she's like, you can't complain to the people that actually have jobs. I was like, yeah, you're right. I got to be quiet. So, I mean, we're just always, right now it's baseball season. So it's time consuming. So my 7-year-old will have practice Mondays and Wednesdays. My 12-year-old has practice Tuesdays and Thursdays. If they have a tournament, it's Saturdays and Sundays. And so it's like, I'm pretty busy throughout the day, and then through, you know, the afternoons, the days is when I can kind of relax and try to get a little bit of a workout in and stay in somewhat of shape so that I can have my whiskey at night and not feel too bad.
We'll end it with this. 2018, you were inducted into the Nevada Wolfpack Hall of Fame. Part of your induction class was with your head coach, Gary Powers. How did you find out that you were inducted into the Wolfpack Hall of Fame?
The university had called me and let me know. And so I thought that was great. You know, I love the University of Nevada. I still love it. Reno still has a soft spot in my heart. I love that town. Love going back there. And so it was pretty cool once we found out, and I have some friends and some ex-teammates that still live in Nevada. So they sent the word out to a ton of the guys from that 2000 team. And so I think we had like 8 to 10 guys, maybe even more than that, maybe 12 guys that were sitting at the table with me from our teams. And so we all got to hang out again and yet again, have some more beers and some more bourbon. That's my weak spot, but just reminiscing, seeing all those guys and knowing that what I accomplished at the university, the 2 years that I was there and what I had accomplished in my big league career was worthy of being put into a university's Hall of Fame was just an honor that was great. And just, you know, made me smile from ear to ear, made my parents, you know, super happy when I told them. I mean, they live out in Southern California, so they got to see a ton of the Wolfpack games because we were in the Big West. So we kind of went up and down California and we never really went too far out east. So it was great that they got to see me pitch all through my collegiate career, watched a ton of my big league career. And just knowing that, you know, forever you're in the Nevada Hall of Fame is just a great deal for me.
Were your kids old enough to understand and appreciate that dad was really good and dad just got this really cool honor?
Yeah. My oldest son. Yeah. He understands it. He was able to, you know, be in the clubhouse with me throughout my big league career and stuff like that. So when I told him that, you know, I was going into the Hall of Fame for my college, he understood what that was, you know. Then of course he asked me about the big league Hall of Fame and I was like, no. So, it's, you know, it's kind of funny how their mind works, but, it was neat having my boys around for the majority of my career and being able to let my older one on the field, and he would take BP with me and he would go shag balls and run around the outfields and stuff like that. And he still remembers that. So, I mean, he was doing it from 7, 8, 9, 10, maybe 9. So he remembers that. My younger one, my 7-year-old, he was too little to remember coming in the clubhouse and stuff, but they were at the dinner for the Hall of Fame. And I think I remember my younger one sitting there playing on my iPhone while I was up there talking, and, you know, mom was making the 12-year-old pay attention. So,
all right. I think that's a good place to end it. You've been extremely generous with your time, Chad. So I don't want to be too greedy here, but you're always welcome in Reno. I'm kind of hoping that maybe your sons end up playing for the Wolfpack one day and that you can continue to come back and be a part of the program in some way. This was really fun.
No
Thank
problem.
You so much for your time.
Yeah, anytime.
Once again, that was Chad Qualls, Nevada Wolfpack Hall of Fame member. This was episode 6 of Howling with the Pack. I'm your host, Josh Sushan, and we will talk to you again next week.